Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight are Jonathan Eller and Ray Bradbury. Jonathan Eller is founding director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. Yes, he's a Hoosier and Chancellor's professor of English at the school, as well as adjunct professor of American Studies, general editor of the new Ray Bradbury Review, general editor of the Collected Stories of Ray Bradbury, as well as senior textual editor in the Institute for American Thought. If any of you have ever seen Ray Bradbury speak live, and I did so once or maybe twice in my life, he was probably the most enthusiastic speaker I've ever seen, maybe on any subject, let alone fiction writing. Fiction writing can be a really exacting, arduous process, and Ray Bradbury made it sound like the most fun you could possibly have with your clothes on. He was so enthusiastic about writing. He talked about as soon as his foot hit the floor when he was getting out of bed in the morning, he was in a race to start working with the language, to start pushing words around the page. And Jonathan Eller has written a biography of Ray Bradbury. I figured who better than Jonathan Eller with the Ray Bradbury Studies Center at Indiana University to talk about the late great author. And with that, Jonathan Eller, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's good to be here with you.
It's great to have you. Thank you for taking the time. You know, let me start with this whole, you're a biographer. You could have written about a million different things, literally a million different things. You decided on Ray Bradbury. Talk about why Ray Bradbury, what drew you to him? What prompted you to write the biography about the great writer?
Well, that biography was pretty much a labor of love, and it's extended into a three-volume trilogy. But it began, I guess you might say, without me ever knowing it was in the future, back around 1962. I was probably about 10 years old or so, and I stumbled across Golden Apples of the Sun. I was already reading science fiction, like a lot of people who grew up with the space age. And I read The Golden Apples of the Sun and the wonderful title story about the crew of astronauts who are sent in a rocket ship that is cooled down to nearly absolute zero. And they're sent in little protective suits inside their spaceship so they won't freeze to death. And they are sent to the surface of the sun with a big scoop to pick up the golden apples of the sun and bring fusion energy back to Earth, to light our planet, to give us energy on Earth. And of course, that is probably the least scientific story anyone could ever imagine about space, but it grabbed me. And over the decades, I realized that it grabbed a lot of other readers. All of his space stories were more or less like that, and they turned so many of us into people who would go on and encounter the space age, or in many cases, work in the space age, like astronauts, astrophysicists, aerospace engineers, astronomers. Then you go forward to about the late 1980s, and I was finishing up my career in the United States Air Force. I was teaching at my alma mater, the U.S. Air Force Academy, at the time, and a wonderful conference was hosted by some of my colleagues there, And they assigned me to be Ray Bradbury's host. My wife and I hosted him for that week, and that's where the relationship began. Improbable as it was, a personal relationship, and that friendship evolved into a working relationship where I would eventually pull together a number of books, and with a fine colleague, Don Albright, who was Ray's principal bibliographer, would edit some special editions of Ray's works over the years. And it was about 2004, after we founded the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University, that I had just finished one book on him, and I decided it's time to write a biography. I knew it would run to multiple volumes. And I brought it up with him, and then I would work with him on successive trips out there, presenting him as I drafted material. The first volume, Becoming Ray Bradbury, came out in 2011. The second volume, Ray Bradbury Unbound, came out in 2014. And finally, the conclusion to the biography, Bradbury Beyond Apollo, was published in 2020. And I had the great good fortune of having my publisher, the University of Illinois Press, bring it out on what would have been Ray's 100th birthday in August of 2020.
Wow. Wow, what a story. You know, you talk about story, the introduction to Ray Bradbury and going to the surface of the sun and getting nuclear fusion energy, which today we are working on, which is today what they're trying to perfect to replace nuclear fission, and find this inexhaustible source of energy that isn't radioactive like fission energy is. And this was way back in the early 60s, I think you said. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's when I encountered the book.
So there you are hosting Ray Bradbury later. And what t tell us what kind of man he was. Very few of us have actually met him and spent time with him. So I'm curious what he was like interpersonally.
Well, he was in what the writer Henry James would call, for me, Ray Bradbury embodied being able to go to that great good place, as Henry James would call it, that great good place in his stories, where you're completely in the imagination, you're in the imaginative world, and you are with this amazing a man who is probably one of the best known writers of our time, and yet he is such a nice guy. He makes eye contact with you. He listens to you. And if you love the things that he loved and loved reading about those things, well, then you were a friend for life. And it was just the way that it worked out. And I would say that there was always that sense of optimism. He called it optimal behaviorism for himself, that was different from sometimes harsh realism of mid-century writing. The lament of modernism that we've lost our values. Ray Bradbury always had an alternative vision, his own mythology. Take us to the stars, and we will have that great good place of Henry James. And so that's kind of what he was like. And every time I'd go to visit, often twice a year, that didn't start until the later 90s. But for the last 15 years of his life, I would go out once or twice a year, spend a week and working on things, working on these projects, going places where he would be, presenting some of his plays, where he would turn his stories often into stage plays, because he had more control over the stage plays if he presented them as alternative theater in the Los Angeles area than he would if he did movies in Hollywood, where he really wasn't in control of anything, or television, where until he did the Ray Bradbury Theater in the 1980s, he really didn't control much of what television did with him on Hitchcock or The Twilight Zone or the other shows that would anthologize his work for video. So, yes, he was a wonderful person to be with. I probably enjoyed every minute over the years.
You know, you say he was a nice guy, and he certainly was, but he was also a guy who spoke his mind. I remember that he said, if Norman Mailer liked something I wrote, I'd probably kill myself. And he also said something very similar to that about Kurt Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut likes something I write, I know I'm in trouble, or I'd kill myself, or something on that order. He obviously there were certain authors he didn't care for, and he was frank about his dislike for them, or his lack of his lack of, or just the feeling that they were not the kind of people who he needed any kind of salute from. Do you read, did you see some of that from him along the way that when you got on certain subjects, he just spoke very directly and bluntly about them? Not those specifically those authors, just generally.
That was part of the fascination of his personality. And here he is, one of the best known faces, voices in American culture, people across the whole spectrum of life and culture in America and around the world would read him. He was published in many, many languages around the world as well. Yes, he was outspoken, and in the sense that he was he did not tolerate intolerance. He did not tolerate intolerance on the far left or the far right. He stood up against McCarthyism at a time when that was not really a smart thing to do in this country in 1952, 53 period of time. And after McCarthy died, he was not at all upset that McCarthy was gone and no longer in the Senate. He was in the literary world. He liked Kurt Vonnegut. They didn't know each other very well. They had met a couple of times, but he did not, as you mentioned, he did not really like Kurt Vonnegut's Cassandra-like, "I will tell you what's wrong about our world, but you won't ever believe me." And of course, Vonnegut knew they would believe him. But Ray took a different approach than Vonnegut. He was not a modernist in exile, lamenting at lost traditions, like we mentioned a few minutes ago, because for him, those traditions were never lost. He loved to look back nostalgically without getting into sentimentality. And there was a very positive nature about him. He was not a mid-century realist, which we also just mentioned a moment ago. Writers who would focus on violence, for instance, he looked for an alternative myth, and that would be space travel and the immortality that that would bring to people. And he would often say, "Do your job. Do your job every day." In that sense, he appreciated Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who was a very important, cultural figure in mid-century America and around the world, as someone who would serve others, a scientist who would serve. But above all, he was a neo-romantic. He loved the great neo-romantic symphonic composers of Hollywood, for instance. He knew a number of them, as a matter of fact. And his, as he moved through life, this idea of optimal behaviorism came really for him from Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, because Ray always appreciated Toynbee's view of history that on through time, there was always going to be a situation of challenge and response for any culture, challenge and response. You are challenged by adverse things in the world, and if your culture turns away from it, your culture will die. If your culture will rise to the challenge, it will live. And he wrote the story, The Toynbee Convector, in the 1980s, about how you can use fiction to create truth. He has an inventor claimed to have gone into the future, seen 100 years from now that we did make it, that we did save our planet, that we did have peace in the world, and he fabricates enough evidence to make it seem that he really did go. So the world chugs on, and when he's an old man at about the age of 130, and that future day arrives when he should have come out of the past and been there, he isn't there because he never did it. But the world made it. Fiction created the truth, and we were all saved. That's Ray Bradbury's kind of optimal behaviorism told in a science fictional way. Very different from these other authors that set the tone in the various movements in 20th century literature.
Now, when he stayed with you, when you hosted him, did he say, that was he writing when he traveled? Did he say, look, I need a few hours in the morning that to get writing done, or did he set the writing aside while he was traveling?
He wrote whenever he could when he traveled, and that goes back to early days in his life as a young as a young boy. Some famous stories about how he came to the realization that the way to live forever is to do what you find that you were destined to do. In his case, it was writing, and he made a pledge at age of 12 to write every day. Well, no one can do that. And he wasn't ever really able to do that, but he tried to write just about every day. And he did, for most days, manage to accomplish that. When he was at the Air Force Academy for that week, he was in a hotel. I would pick him up every time, and we would take him to events. And sometimes we would take him to quiet time to escape, to get away from things. But he had work with him. He was working on the second of his detective novels, A Graveyard for Lunatics, which were really autobiographical novels that he did late in life to show the Hollywood of the day when he was an up-and-coming writer and when he was also writing in Hollywood as an established writer. And he was working on that novel even during the trip. And yes, you are right, it was mornings. The time of the morning was the best time for him to work. And so, probably for the vast majority of days in his life, he would get something done on that typewriter, his lifetime companion.
What was the appeal of Ray Bradbury to so many people? We understand what your his appeal was to you, but when you look at the broad audience, the millions of people who've read his books, what do you think? Why do you think he attracted so many readers and retained so many readers? What was that essential appeal?
Well, there are several hallmarks for Ray Bradbury. One is the style. His writing was poetic, it was metaphor rich, and it was centered on emotional truth. That's very important for him. And where we begin to read him, as his writing is evolving in the 40s and into the 50s, the 40s, the 50s into the 60s are when he does his best work. And that starts with supernatural suspense, the Bradbury twist, the unexpected ending, horror, light horror and supernatural fiction without showing you a monster generally. Everybody still appreciates that kind of Ray Bradbury writing. They'll be in a mysterious situation, or even there's a Twilight Zone episode where an eerie situation occurs in a diner, and the great character actor Jack Elam is sitting there, and he says, "Why, this is starting to sound like a Ray Bradbury story." So he it was pervasive in the culture that way, and of course. He wanted to take humanity to the stars, even though he was not numerate. He had never gone to college. He had no science to speak of, other than in high school, an interest in biology and such. But science fiction, through my lifetime growing up in the 50s and 60s, and into my military career in the early 70s, I saw Ray Bradbury's dreams become our dreams too. He would examine what is it like to be human? What does being human mean? How can we take our humanity out to the stars? He was interested in imaginative freedom, and that echoes down through Fahrenheit 451 and other cautionary tales that he points out to us. And then everything that he would touch on, like the nature of good and evil, of life and death, he would answer these questions in universal ways that would stay with you. Everybody has read a Ray Bradbury story, and they may not even remember that he wrote it, but if you describe the story to them, they'll know who it is. So that's where he is. He's so deeply embedded in our culture. Those are the things: his style, his ability to write supernatural fiction and science fiction without really writing in those forms at all in a traditional way. That's what stays with people. That's the appeal.
What was the appeal at Indiana University when you, as founding director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies, I'm assuming you proposed this, or somebody proposed the idea of having the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. What was the reception on that? Did the administration immediately say that's a great idea, or did they ask, what's Ray Bradbury's connection to this university? Why us versus some other university? How'd that come about?
Well, that's interesting sidebar in itself. When I retired from the Air Force in 1993, I'd been in operational duties, and I had also been in academic duties, teaching at the Air Force Academy, and then later at the Naval Academy on exchange duty. And finally, in 93, I retired, came to Indiana University Indianapolis campus, and there I joined a colleague who had also an interest in Ray Bradbury, who had published a couple of monograph books on Ray Bradbury, the late Professor William Tupontz. He and I did things on Ray Bradbury, and as my relationship with Bradbury developed personally, then back here in Indiana, Bill and I asked to form a Center for Ray Bradbury Studies as a research operation, primarily to publish archival volumes of his earliest stories in their earliest forms from the 40s and 50s, primarily the 40s, with stories from the pulps before he would revise them and put them in his famous story collections in the 1950s. And then we did a journal, the New Ray Bradbury Review. Those were pretty much Bill's ideas. I ended up putting the volumes together because that was part of my academic training, was the forensic work that goes into recovering the texts of an author. But in 2007, Bill and I were able to co-found the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies. Now, a university doesn't commit a lot of resources to this kind of endeavor. They'll encourage you, and at key moments, they will help you out. But you really have to generate your own time and your own resources for it. Then everything changed at around 2011 when I became the sole director and Bill retired. 2012, actually, when Ray Bradbury passed away in Los Angeles. We brought out, through gifts from Don Albright, whom I mentioned earlier, his principal bibliographer, and his daughters, his family, gifted us his office, his papers, his correspondence, his own personal copies of books, and his working library, his furniture, and a lifetime of his awards and mementos. And that's when the university would make commitments periodically to help us out. They helped us get a 53-foot Mayflower moving van with 18,000 pounds of Ray Bradbury's World in it from Los Angeles to the university. They provided space for storage while we developed things. And then I put together with facilities people a place to set up his office in exactly the way it was in his house in Cheviot Hills in West Los Angeles. So that's how it worked out. But there was always that challenge. In my academic lifetime, Ray Bradbury has come to become accepted in the academic world. Some very famous critics like Harold Bloom and a few others, Eric Rapkin and others, began to privilege Ray Bradbury. Critics like Gary K. Wolfe, and he was able to come into the academic world a bit, and then our books helped to do that as well. But really, I guess it was our efforts and our relationship with Ray Bradbury and Ray Bradbury himself reaching out to help me do these things and write these books that made it possible. He was a child of the Midwest. I should add that. He was a child of the Midwest. He was born and raised, born in 1920 in Waukegan, Illinois, in the North Shore of Lake Michigan, north of Chicago. And he lived there on and off until he was almost 14. Then, during the depths of the Depression, his family went west to find work, and he spent the rest of his long life in Los Angeles. But he's a child of the Midwest. The University of Illinois Press published my three-book biography trilogy So Indiana University had to make a leap of faith to take us on, close but not quite Ray Bradbury country, and we appreciate what they did for us.
Now, Ray Bradbury's first love, first great love was magic, actually. And he has said that if he had not become a writer, he might have been a magician. And but it was at age 17 that he decided that he wanted to become a professional writer. Fiction writing is a really a form of magic. I mean, you're creating things out of particularly the type of writing Ray Bradbury did, which was heavy on the imagination and science fiction, a look into the future or possible futures and so on. What really led him up to that decision to become a professional writer at such a young age, at age 17? Was there an event in his life that made him decide, this is what I want to do, this is really what I'm here to do?
Yes, and to use his words, that story is super fascinating. If he had an interesting story to tell you, he'd say, "Oh, well, that's super fascinating." You know, that was a part of his idiom. You know, like, and he'd always say, "Sure, swell." If you'd want to do something with him, and he'd say, "Yes," he'd say, "Swell. Everything is swell." It's sort of like, you know, my father used to use that phrase all the time. So Ray Bradbury had that way of saying things like that, and his story was indeed super fascinating. Magic, writing, and acting, those were his early loves. And I always felt that in a way, those three things, you know, he wanted humanity to transcend death by going to the stars. Well, you can transcend your own death in a way and not be forgotten if you can perform magic, if you can become a writer. And if you can become an actor and portray the literature of the past in the present. So he started, I think, my theory is that he started by learning from toys. He had, to the end of his days, toys all over his house. And he would learn from magicians. He saw Blackstone, the great magician, a couple of times in Waukegan when he would tour, and Ray would see him, and actually got tapped as a kid to come up once and participate in a trick, and he got one of Blackstone's rabbits for doing that there in Waukegan in the late 1920s, around 1930. He was fascinated by hypnotism and was easily hypnotized himself. And then in 1932, at the age of 12, he encounters in a sideshow of a small circus that would come to town, a sideshow act, or, you know, from, you know, the midway part of a circus, a small circus, Mr. Electrico, who was a guy who would do the old static electricity act, where, you know, you're grounded, but he could make fantastic things happen and sparks fly with the electricity. And Ray gets called up again because he is one of those kids who had that face of wonderment that made you want to pick him for things. And so Mr. Electrico would bring him out, and he would reach down with the electrified sword from his grounded position, and he would let the arc jump across, boom, to Ray Bradbury's forehead. And he would have to say something. He would have to, Mr. Electrico would have to say something. And the words he used at that point were, "Live forever." And it's a very popular story about Ray Bradbury. A lot of people know it. It's part of the mystique of Ray Bradbury. But he realized that from that point on, well, this guy's given me this great responsibility. I have to live forever. How am I going to do it? And he began to get that idea of wanting to be a writer. And that's how you live beyond your time, if you are a successful writer. So that was the moment. Then at age 17, I guess that year pops up. You mentioned age 17, probably because he's a senior in high school and he's invited to join the Los Angeles chapter of the Science Fiction League, LASFL at the time. It's since 1940, it's been the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society. And as a member, as one of the younger members there, he's in a world now where, besides the professional science fiction writers, and some of them come to that organization, there are so many fan writers who write fanzines, not prozines, not the pulps that are professionally printed and sold, but fan magazines. It was almost like a pen pal club around the country. And he would start to write, very apprentice, very amateur things for them. So from 17 on, he's beginning to write. By 1941, when he's 21, he sells his first story for money. And from there on, those are the milestones of his writing life, and he never forgot those years and those events.
Now, my understanding, just in the effort to create his own immortality as a writer, he worked in his basement of his Los Angeles home. That's my understanding, and that he had quite a work ethic. Sometimes he'd write 7 days a week. And what do we know? What do you know about his work ethic and about his writing regimen? I know you alluded to this earlier. If you were to kind of summarize his regular routine as a writer, what did that look like?
Well, it was an interesting dynamic, and I saw a lot of it in later life, but it hadn't changed much from his early life at all. He had that pledge in his own mind to write every day when he could. And he generated thousands of stories. And so the dynamic would be, whatever new came up, that would upwell from his subconscious. That's what he felt. Dorothea Brand wrote a book about writing from the subconscious, not resisting it. Let it come up and be patient. And so he believed in that quite a bit. And so he'd wait for the old subcon, as he called it, to work with him. And when it would work, a story would come up. He'd start to write it. But he also had a lot of stories he hadn't finished. It would sort of fade into the background for a while, and he would come back to these stories. So he would work on the new story of the week or the new several stories of the week, but he would often go back and then work on what eventually became thousands of stories. He eventually would publish well over 400 stories in many, many different forms, and then there were all these other stories he could always turn back to, and he would go back to them from time to time. What he did, he had the home office, the house he lived in from roughly 1958 till the end of his life, was in Cheviot Hills in West LA, and he would maintain that office in the basement, and a lot of the writing got done there in those last four decades of his life. But it started in the powerhouse, which was where he lived with his parents starting in 1942 to 1947. His dad worked for the power and light company, a utility company in Venice Beach, in Venice, which is basically continuous with Los Angeles. They're heading out toward the shore. And there was the substation of the power company had a substation there, one of those classic, early 20th century brick buildings, where the power would come in at a high voltage and would be stepped down to residential voltages. Well, that was in the yard. And then there was a garage with a window that faced that magical building where the little machines ran all day and all night. And his dad and his brother and his mom lived in a little house attached to that powerhouse. And they, maintained it for the power company. And he would sit in that office in the garage and watch the power and the electricity. And that was more magic, see? That was more magic for him. And that was where he first had an office. Then from about 51, he had a little office in his home in Clarkson Road in West LA. Where he could be, away from his growing family. He could be out in the yard at the garage and write. But then the Cheviot Hills office, for a few years, maybe in the 1980s, he had office on Wilshire Boulevard, but he never stopped writing at home. And beginning in the 80s on through till the early 2000s, he also wrote in a weekend home they had in Palm Springs. And he would maintain that whole process of writing new things constantly, whatever welled up, and finishing them if he was lucky, which happened more often than not, and then sometimes going back to older materials always there in his filing cabinets. He wrote in the mornings, fairly religiously, so that when things would come up in the day, further on in the afternoon, or if he had events to go to, which began to pull him away from writing more and more as he became famous in the especially in the 60s on, then he would have at least written in the morning, that crucial time of day. So that was a routine, and I would see that all the way through pretty much, the rest of his life.
Now, is it true that he was afraid of the dark until age 20?
Well, I don't think that those of us who are susceptible to the power of suggestion, I don't think it ever completely leaves us. Sure, I'd say that's a fair statement. He had an incredibly strong power of suggestion. That's probably why he was a great subject for hypnosis. They'd go to, he and his wife, Marguerite, Maggie Bradbury, would go, they might go see a magician's act, and the magician would do the trick where he would, evaluate the audience and say, "Everybody, put your hands up." And then he would have done a few subliminals, and then he would say, "Okay, you won't be able to put your hands down unless I give you the cue word." And he would, magician would say, "Okay, put your hands down," and Bradbury would be invariably still there with his hand up in the audience. So, and he would later in life find that hypnosis helped with pain. He would go to, in some years, he would go to hypnodontist experts, that is, dentists that used hypnosis rather than painkiller. And it, to some degree, it worked for him. So he had this tremendous power of suggestion. But he was afraid of the dark naturally because he was suggestible from an early age in the Waukegan house. The bathroom was downstairs. He would have to come down in the dark to go to the bathroom, come down to the landing and come down and turn the lights on and rush to get upstairs before somebody would turn the light off again. So, and he would write about these things. But about the dark, the central thing for Ray Bradbury in the dark was the ravine, which was a formation. Waukegan has some interesting ravine formations that are geologically known and studied. And his neighborhood was in a little enclave that reached out into the ravine, and down below the ravine, which he had to cross to get to Central School up through the 7th grade for most of his elementary school time. And that ravine and the little bridge across the creek in that ravine was darkness personified. And his brother, his older brother Skip, would occasionally scare him. He'd get ahead of him or get behind him and scare him coming through the ravine, coming back from the movie theaters. So the ravine, and the fact that there were nighttime criminals like the Lonely One who would rob businesses and such, allowed Ray's imagination as he grew into maturity and into adulthood to help craft some of the most terrifying stories of suspense, such as the one in Dandelion Wine, which was published separately as The Whole Town's Sleeping, about the woman that goes to the theater one night when the Lonely One is out. And on the way back, she's very brave. She goes to the theater alone. Her friends won't go with her. They're scared. She makes it all the way home through the ravine, lets herself into her house, locks the door, and then hears a man clearing his throat in the darkness behind her in her house. So that's one of the great Ray Bradbury suspense stories. And it all, I think, emerges from his feelings about the dark.
Interesting. So my understanding is his favorite authors were Jules Verne, Mark Twain, and H.G. Wells, all very famous, all displayed great imagination. What is there anything to be said about those particular authors?
Well, sure. Yes, Jules Verne to him meant a lot, especially when he was older. He encountered Jules Verne as a young person and loved him. The whole business about firing a giant shell to the moon with people in it, around the world in 80 days, Mysterious Island. Yeah, those things appealed to him with Verne. And later on, he would write introductions to some special editions of those books. And he really did enjoy Jules Verne and was a special guest of the French government at the I think 150th anniversary of Verne's death. I'm sorry, of Jules Verne's birth in the 1950s in Paris. Mark Twain, he came to love, but mostly Twain's short stories because, Bradbury also started out as a short story writer, just like Twain did. And then H.G. Wells. Oh, Wells, he loved Wells. The Invisible Man to H.G. Wells was the epitome of the paranoia of all young men, to take over the world. And so he actually loved Wells. One of the first things he did when he had money from his paper route after he graduated high school, he went out and went to an arcade and got one of those booths where you could record a record. And this is in the 1930s, late 1930s, and he did a reading from Jules from H.G. Wells to cut the little record. So he loved them, but as he would grow up, he had loved Poe, Edgar Rice Burroughs, then Verne, Twain, and Wells. And then later, as an adult, on his own reading, he would really enjoy and always had a heart for Steinbeck, a lot of Hemingway, though not all, Thomas Wolfe, a great love of many people when they're young in life, Eudora Welty, Willa Cather, Edith Wharton, Bernard Shaw, G.K. Chesterton. John Collier, who would write great suspense and supernatural stories. And of course, the standards, Hawthorne, Washington Irving, Poe, and then some friends. He enjoyed the nonfiction writing of Lauren Isley, for instance. So that's sort of a quick thumbnail sketch about his favorite authors radiating out from your original choice of Verne, Twain, and Wells.
Now, he made only $4,000 in income on his 10th year of writing, and less the previous 9 years, he said. So clearly persistence was part of his success. When you stop and think about it, you spend 10 years trying to achieve success with writing. You're not making much money. He could have easily given up. He didn't. He persisted. And obviously his career bloomed after that, but what about that persistence? What about the fact that he wasn't doing well financially in those first say the first 10 years anyway, and yet he didn't lose faith in his ability to and maybe I guess another part of this question is really did he expect to make a lot of money as a writer, or was he thinking, this is what I love to do, and if I have to live a quite thrifty life to do this, that's what I'm going to do.
Yes, I would say that he wanted to write no matter what. Writing was important to him. It was like breathing. He had to write. And he would have, and he did endure the challenges of starting out really when the effects of the Depression were still in our culture, even as World War II began, and we get into that period of time. Sure, in the early 40s, when he starts publishing professionally, his first sale, he gets $16 for co-writing a story, Pendulum, that in the science fiction magazines. He was only making with Weird Tales, where he became a fixture during the war years. He was making 0.5 cent a word initially, then 1 cent a word, then 1.5 cents a word with Weird Tales and some of the other pulps. And the story writing was slow. In 1941, he publishes one. In 42, he publishes two, then 11, then 19, then 13 in 1945. But two of them are in the Slick magazines, and they bring him more money. And then 18 in 46, three of them are in the Slick magazines, like Collier's and Mademoiselle. And by this time, he's starting to win a placement in O. Henry Prize volumes and Best American Short Story volumes. And there, he's making that transition out of the pulps into the mainstream magazines. And money would always be tight, especially for a short story writer who would pull together some of the stories to form things that are novelized story cycles. But money was really tight until probably the 1960s for them. And the time that by that time he and Maggie had four daughters at home. So they were frugal people all the way.
You know, one of the quotes I picked up from Ray Bradbury from an interview, a Q&A interview from one of the magazines said, and this is, I'm quoting Ray Bradbury here, real thinking, and this is to your earlier point, Jonathan. He says, real thinking always occurs on the subconscious level, and it is important for writers to get away from the keyboard and allow that to take place while doing other activities. Very much a believer in that. That the subconscious mind is at work, probably always at work, and that that's what really needed to be tapped to do one's finest work. And we're told as writers all the time that don't edit as you go, precisely for that reason, because if you edit as you go, what you're doing is you're kind of hitting the brake and the accelerator at the same time. You're never going to gain full momentum. You're never really going to tap the subconscious mind because you're second guessing everything that might come from there, and you know, basically get out of the way. Any thoughts about that?
Yes, he was a great believer that you have to let the subconscious lead before you get to the keyboard. He'd have to look around and get ideas. Often that would be his office by the time that he would have an office. And you look around at your things and you come up with ideas, or you word associate. He was big on word association, and he would come up with stories that way, like the veldt, the lake. These little word associations would sometimes get him going too. And he also believed, or he made a deal with himself, that he would let the characters tell their own stories so he could keep self-consciousness out of the process by the time he then goes to the keyboard, writes quickly, and would often get these 3,000 to 5,000 word stories out in one afternoon in draft, and then revise later, and then bring rational thought to it, and then be self-conscious about it, but not during the first draft.
It's very hard to do, very hard for writers to do that. My own experience is that it's very difficult, and I see that with so many other writers as well. Now, he says he never consciously set out to write a particular story, but rather to imitate form. Organically or spontaneously, just imitate form, which again suggests that he was trying to start with really just kind of an impression and then allow it to develop organically, just to allow it to take its own shape, not really to control the process so much as to let it develop out of his own, what did he call the subconscious mind? Subcon?
Yeah, the old subcon.
The old subcon.
Well, yeah, and that's a good follow-on to what we were just talking about. Sure, his best work was when he could dramatize a story focused on a single idea and infuse it with intensity and vitality. Don't think, do. He had that on a clipboard. He had that above his typewriter. Avoid the logic and the self-conscious thought. And so, organically and spontaneously, and it didn't always work, but most of the time it did. And sometimes he published stories that weren't that great, but there are a surprising number of stories across his life, especially in the 40s, 50s, and the 60s, where he is able to dramatize with great intensity and vitality. And this would appeal to the readers by way of dramatization, by poetic language, by metaphor-rich style that we've talked about, and that all would come together for him in that way. And it was more or less a spontaneous, integrated or organic process.
You know, don't think, just write. There's also Ayn Rand used different words than Ray Bradbury did, but she really said the same thing, just as much as possible. You want to be writing without actually thinking, which takes a little while to wrap your head around because you have to figure, I'm always thinking if I'm writing, but there's a level that you can get to, or depth that you can get to, where you're not really doing so much thinking as you are. Well, I remember one time a writer had said, I forget who it was, a well-known publisher author said that you're re really in the channel when you're really reading words off the page, more than you're not thinking about what you're writing, but you're actually reading them as they appear on the page. Obviously, this the old subcon has kicked in that at that point. A lot of people have said that, although I think Ray Bradbury boiled it down to just the perfect phrase: just don't think, just write. He did say ideas excite me. And as soon as I get excited, the adrenaline gets going. And the next thing I know, I'm borrowing energy from the ideas themselves. That sounds almost metaphysical. Did Ray Bradbury have a spiritual or metaphysical belief system?
Well, Ray was traditionally, he was a Midwest Baptist kid. He in his teenage years fell away and became an atheist for a period of time. But he never lost his ability to be an observer. He was a close observer of life. He had empathy and he had the ability to observe. He sampled the great religions. He would go to churches. He would go to synagogue just, to see what the dynamic was there. He would, when they lived in LA, he would go to the Vedanta temple, with the Eastern philosophy and religions, because some of the famous British expatriate writers that he would come to know, like Huxley and Aldous Huxley and Christopher Isherwood and Gerald Hurd, would go there, and he would go and see, what moved them. But ultimately, it came for him that he believed in the mysteries and wonders of the cosmos. Nothing unique there. A lot of science fiction writers follow this route, but he had a slightly different path to take in the mysteries and wonders of the cosmos. And he eventually saw our cultural passion to explore as a way to take, the way he would see it, is it to take God back out to the universe from the world that was created here, where there's not often evidence of an immanent God anymore, except through faith, but take God back out to the universe by conquering the stars. And in that, he's influenced by Nikos Kazantzakis's book, The Saviors of God, from the late 1950s or early 60s. I think it was the late 50s. And the whole idea that Kazantzakis takes from Henri Bergson, the Nobel Prize winning writer, Henri Bergson, and his concept of the élan vital, the life force that's in protoplasm and the protoplasm that constitutes us. There is a life force, that will to live. And Ray felt that that is the essence of our creator that we take back out to the universe through ourselves. So that's about as metaphysical as Ray would get, but it fits his character and his ideas about going to the stars.
Yes. I found in my notes that those quotes about Mailer and Vonnegut, I'll just read it here. If I found out that Norman Mailer liked me, I'd have killed myself. I think he was too hung up. I'm glad Kurt Vonnegut didn't like me either. He had problems, terrible problems. He couldn't see the world the way I see it. I suppose I'm too much Pollyanna. He was too much Cassandra. To the point you were making earlier, Jonathan. He also says he was, you mentioned he was not university educated. He said that he was completely library educated. Here's a guy who didn't go to college, but was a very learned man. He obviously spent a lot of time in the library, reading all manner of books. What about his level of education? Just he obviously an autodidact, self-educated. What about his level of education?
Well, he graduated from Los Angeles High School in 1938. He did, let's see, he did the 8th grade at Berendo Junior High, and then 9, 10, 11, and 12 at LA High School. He did not stand out. He was not good in a classroom or lecture environment. He learned by going to the library. and stimulating himself with book choices, sometimes suggested by his teachers and some of his mentor writers at the Los Angeles Science Fiction League. And he had to remediate English grammar before he could graduate. That class initially in the 10th grade had not really interested him. He had excelled in the 11th and 12th grade, and I think the 10th grade as well, with electives in English, with two of his teachers, one Snow Longley Houch, who was his poetry teacher, and Jeanette Johnston, who was a had been a Stanford grad back in the 20s, before there were a lot of women who went to Stanford before that time. And she was an outstanding literature teacher, and she knew enough to let this kid find his own way, you know, imitating people at first, and then finding his own abilities, his own realization finally that that the things he knew best, the hopes and fears and loves and hates, and terrors and joys of childhood that translate and grow with us until we're adults. Those are the things Ray Bradbury knew the best. And teachers like Jeanette Johnson helped him find his way. But he graduates from high school without anything to go to. He couldn't go to college. His family was on and off what used to be called relief back in the day. His dad would work for the power companies, you know, from time to time. And his older brother, Skip, worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps, would send, you know, the $20 a month home to his family. But so Ray sold newspapers the 4 years after high school on a street corner in Los Angeles, making 1 penny off of every 3 cent paper that he sold. Those were his 4 years after high school. But he was writing and writing and writing. And you produce a lot of bad stuff before you can produce good stuff. And he saw movie after movie after movie. Sometimes he'd trade newspapers to get into the movie theater. And if you watch every movie made in Hollywood in the 20s and 30s and 40s, you see a lot of bad movies and a lot of good movies, and you learn what's good and what's bad. So he's a self-taught critic, a self-taught writer who found in the library his life force. His elan vital really came out of the library.
He also said, great piece of advice for writers here. He says that your instincts are everything for a writer. He also says he never kept a notebook. A lot of writers keep a notebook and they say, if I get an idea, I jot it down. He says, as soon as I get an idea, I write a short story or I start a novel or I do a poem. So I have no need for a notebook. So he was very much a day-to-day in the moment kind of writer, rather than, well, I'll take a note and I might get to it someday or not. He just acted on it. Obviously, it had to be a strong idea or he wouldn't waste his time on it. But he did that. It becomes either a novel or a short story or a poem. Now, he was a short story writer and a novelist, Jonathan. What do you think was his greatest strength if one was any stronger than the other? Do you think he was more a short story writer or more of a novelist, or was it a wash?
He was a natural short story writer. He would call himself a sprinter, because if you think about that dynamic of go with the idea that wells up from your subconscious, that's really a framework for short story writing. He was truly a teller of tales. And I use that term, which is a translation of Tusitala, which is a Samoan term, which means teller of tales, that the Samoans gave to their visitor who spent the end of his life there at the turn of the century, Robert Louis Stevenson, a writer that Bradbury himself loved quite a bit for his short stories. But Bradbury was also a Tusitala, a teller of tales, a sprinter, let the story well up, get it down fast. And the risk was he could have been, and was for part of his early career, the only prominent writer since Edgar Allan Poe who had not succeeded also as a novelist. And the effort to do that was similar to what Mark Twain went through in the 1870s into the 1880s, to try out all kinds of ways to pull together things and stitch together things that would eventually become almost novels like Life on the Mississippi, and finally a novel in Huck Finn by 1885. The Bradbury had that risk. Fahrenheit 451 was really in 1953 a very short novella that he doubled in length into a novel. But it's really Something Wicked This Way Comes that becomes his first true novel. And then two of the detective novels he wrote late in life, Death is a Lonely Business and Graveyard for Lunatic. So he succeeds finally as a novelist, but really his bread and butter, and including the air he breathed, was the air of a short story writer's heritage.
So Ray Bradbury also said, "My passions drive me to the typewriter every day of my life, and they have driven me there since I was 12, so I never have to worry about schedules." He also said, "I wake up, I have what I call the theater of morning inside my head, all these voices talking to me." He also said, "I don't understand writers who have to work at it." Yeah, lucky Ray Bradbury. Too bad for the rest of us. He also said, "I like to play. I'm interested in having fun with ideas, throwing them up in the air like confetti and then running under them. If I had to work at it, I would give it up. I don't like working." A funny statement from a guy who obviously was a very hardworking guy. He had that Midwestern work ethic because he selling newspapers for a penny a piece, and his dedication to writing and so on. So he lives to age 91, dies in Los Angeles at age 91. As you look back over his full body of work, Jonathan, what do you see as Ray Bradbury's marks of distinction in his writing? What really made him stand out, or were those marks of distinction?
Well, I think again that goes back to that the great good fortune he had was finally to look into himself and realize that what he was good at was that metaphor-rich poetic style. He felt that you can't teach metaphor. He didn't think he was headed anywhere after high school, but he had this ability to think and write in metaphors. That's a mark of distinction. Dramatizing ideas to great effect, as we said earlier, was a great mark of distinction. And then this whole business of writing emotional truth, he would say, if you write the truth, you automatically have a style. Those things are synonymous. And he felt that if he honestly was sincere about the truth of a story, the hidden idea of a story, then and it felt right, then he knew that he had written something that other people would identify with. He loved to find how many people in this world loved the things that he loved and loved the way he wrote about them. And that's the core of his distinction as a writer.
What other than writing and his wife, Maggie, did he love in life? What was his greatest love other than writing and, say, his wife?
Well, I would say that, again, that would be to know that others loved what he loved was a love in itself for him. But also, he loved every day that he went into his office, especially that basement home office. And for a time, the office on Wilshire, where he had taken many of those great objects of his life and used them to generate ideas. His muse, in a way, was his office and his treasures. And of course, in the early days, he loved the metaphorical power that came out of that little power station in Venice Beach from 1942 to 1947, when he finally, at the age of 27, got married and moved away from home. Those were the things that were the greatest loves in his life, other than the writers. Now, the greatest love of his life collectively would be the books on the shelves in the library. He always wanted to be on the shelves between Mr. Baum and Mr. Burroughs, and not far from Miss Dickinson and Herman Melville. And he always felt sincerely his love for books, because he knew that in this world, if you burn a book, you burn the author. And if you burn the author, you destroy the humanity of us. Mm.
Tell us there's so many things that we've talked about regarding Ray Bradbury that are kind of surprising, like being afraid of the dark until age 20. But tell us something that people would be surprised to know about Ray Bradbury that we haven't already mentioned.
Well, there's a million and one little things I can think of because I was around him so much of the time, and it was so easy to be with him. And he would take us on trips all around the place. I guess you could say things like, well, really, his favorite ice cream was peppermint ice cream, you know? But as far as something that people probably would find fascinating is he's known for those big, black, thick glasses, black rimmed, owl-like thick glasses. I mean, I've done books where photos for the cover were rejected by my publishers because Ray had his glasses off. Because the magic of Ray Bradbury is seeing him with those big glasses on and those big questing eyes staring out through those glasses. Well, people didn't know this, but late in life, he tended to wear those glasses with no glass in them at all. He had been incredibly myopic, but he had the surgery done, which tightened up the eyeballs. I forget what that is. It's
Oh,
the
LASIK surgery?
yes. He
Yeah.
finally, very late in life, had LASIK surgery. In the last, I don't know, 8 or 10 years I was going out, there wasn't any glass in the glasses at all. But he knew he had to wear them, or people would it would be like seeing, the Lone Ranger without his mask on. And so that's something a lot of people don't know, that really late in life he could see pretty well again, but he still wore the glasses for the people he visited.
Interesting. Just a couple more questions. What do you see as the major writing lesson, or maybe the single biggest writing lesson that Ray Bradbury, either explicitly or implicitly, has conveyed to the fiction writers around the world?
Well, I think that a lot of writers, and I just published Remembrance, which is my compilation of his correspondence through his lifetime. We have about 300 letters in the volume. Came out with Simon and Schuster in November. Remembrance, the correspondence selected of Ray Bradbury. What writers appreciated about him that I wrote to, like Richard Bach and others, other pretty well-known writers. Was they appreciated the fact that he wanted to write every day and that he wanted to write with conviction. And that he would say his admonition was believe in yourself, believe in yourself. You see, you mentioned Ayn Rand, and I will tell you that one of the most influential books on him at the age of 24, 25 was The Fountainhead. Not because of anything political, but because Howard Roark, the architect of that novel, against all odds, is determined to go his own way and do the kind of architectural designs that the establishment did not want, and finally succeed at it. And that showed Ray Bradbury as a young man that you have to believe in yourself, go your own way against the odds, and for 7 decades, he was able to do that as a writer successfully. And those are the things that other writers, I think, appreciate about him.
And to our listeners, in the episode notes, you'll find a link to Jonathan Eller's page where you can find all of the books that he's written, as well as the work he does at Indiana University, and also a link to raybradbury.com, where you can learn more about Ray Bradbury. But in closing, Jonathan, how do you see Ray Bradbury's place in the annals of fiction writing or science fiction writing? Where does he place?
Well, now, looking back now, with Ray no longer with us, except in a very tangible spirit, he's still with us. And the fact that I've been retired now for 3 years, so I've moved away from all of these other projects, and live in Southern Indiana now. But I see Ray's place in the annals of fiction as clearly as I did while I was working on his life and legacy, and that is. His place is that he was able to navigate the boundary between popular culture and the literary mainstream and do it well and do it successfully. And there were always critics who could never forgive him for his success. But he managed to do it, which is why he's so broadly popular even now in the 21st century.
Why couldn't they forgive him for his success? What was the issue there?
Well, he didn't follow the conventions. He didn't belong to the establishment. He didn't write science fiction. Science fiction for Ray Bradbury was a wonderful armature for him to put his more universal stories of life and our humanity together. He was not an orthodox science fiction writer. Tony Boucher said, you know, Ray Bradbury is the best known science fiction writer around who never wrote science fiction at all. And there would be the detective writing business and the suspense and mystery writing business. He never followed the rules. He never used ratiocination. He never figured out who did it, who did the murder, and worked backwards. He worked forwards. He'd start a story or a novel and not know who did the killing. It didn't matter because he knew it would come to him. And sometimes he overwrote. Something Wicked This Way Comes is one of the great novels about the nature of life and death and terror and fear. And yet it's somewhat overwritten. And critics who were irritated by the fact that he could be so popular across our culture and around the world did it without an education and without without belonging to the club, you know, without belonging to the establishment. And I think every once in a while you'll still run into critics who nail him for that. But by and large, a surprising number of British writers, American writers, and critics and artists loved Ray Bradbury. And that's really the important part of the legacy, that and his readership.
Again, my guest has been Jonathan Eller. He is a Ray Bradbury biographer, as well as the founding director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing your insights about Ray Bradbury with us.
Thank you, Mike. It was a real pleasure.